Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com.
All right, I'm really excited for this episode. Today we interviewed provider attorney Andrew Burgess out of Cincinnati, Ohio, and the story of success that he has been able to achieve as pretty much a brand new attorney. We've had a few attorneys that have had almost brand new practices coming on board with Unbundled Attorney to help them launch their practice and get more clients going early on. But this is a great story as well, just another example of that. He started in September. This podcast was recorded at the very beginning of December, and he's been able to acquire almost 60 to 65 clients in this 3 to 4 month period, new paying clients. And so just fantastic amount of clients coming on board, great conversion rate. But one of the things that we really get into in this episode, and I think sets it apart, is the economics, the true economics of Unbundled and offering payment plans and pay-as-you-go options to their clients. You know, I think a lot of attorneys, the reason they offer $5,000 retainers and that's it is because they believe that, you know, they're not going to be able to make much money on clients that don't have a lot of money. You know, there's this myth that if you work with low-income people, you have to make low income. And that's something that I think in this podcast episode, with the examples that Andrew gives and the transparency and the detail on each of the options he provides and how it pencils out for him financially, really dispels that myth. And we've got obviously a lot of podcast episodes and tons of attorneys, hundreds of lawyers across the United States that in our network that have proven that to be the case. But this is a real detailed analysis of each of these options and the finances of each one, and also the strategies you need to implement in order to make sure that you aren't overstepping those boundaries. You're finding a way to fit your services into the budget of these clients, and at the same time, still getting paid well for your time and not getting in a position where you're not. And so there's a lot of great examples here from Unbundled to pay-as-you-go to payment plans. And I think it's really going to be helpful for those, especially of you that are starting to consider offering these options, or if you just started and getting more creative about the way you can go about doing so. So with that, let's get right into this episode, this interview with Andrew Burgess, one of our provider attorneys out of Cincinnati, Ohio. All right, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate you coming on to share your story a bit about how these last 3 months of, you know, coming on board and fielding these leads and working with us has gone. From what I've heard, it's been a pretty successful launch and startup. And I thank you for taking the time to share, you know, the strategies you developed over these last 3 months working with our team, with Graham, to have such a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at this point, I don't know how it could be going any better. You know, it's been way beyond any of my expectations.
Great. Yeah. So, before we kind of dive into, you know, what those results have been and you know, and how you've been able to accomplish that, maybe just a first step is give a bit of background on, you know, how you got your start in the practice of law, the area you service, and the areas of law you're providing services in.
Sure. So I went to the University of Cincinnati for law school and stayed in town. I clerked at a couple different firms while in school, and then kind of looked around afterwards and made the decision that I wanted to go off on my own, and just jumped right in there, which is pretty scary. And for the most part, I didn't really know much about solo practice. I just kind of went for it.
How long after was it when you graduated that you started going in from solo? Like when you graduated from law school, were you clerking throughout law school and then, you know, pretty much straight into a solo practice? Or did you, after you graduated, you did the clerking and got some experience and then went into solo practice after you've done that for a while?
Yeah, so the clerking carried over after law school. So it was probably maybe 9 months after I was licensed that I started, just went off on my own.
Wow, okay. So was that your plan throughout law school? As you were thinking, you weren't quite sure whether you're going to get a job with a law firm, or were you always thinking through your law practice that, hey, I want to run my own solo practice, I want to start my own business, and pretty shortly after graduate school or graduating from law school, that's something you'd want to get into once you felt a little more comfortable and experienced?
You know, I had not considered it very seriously at all during school. It wasn't like a goal I had or anything like that. It's kind of funny what actually led me to ultimately doing it is, you know, I was clerking, and then one of my friends got into a bit of trouble and needed some help. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll help you out through this case. And I got in the courtroom and got hooked on that. And I was like, wow, I love this way better than what I'm doing at this law firm that I'm at. And I think I can make a go of this on my own. You know, because you don't need that many clients over the course of a month to really make ends meet. So I figured I would just jump in and see what I can do on my own. And so I just went for it.
Yeah, we've had a number of attorneys on the podcast that made that jump straight out of law school. And, you know, they've talked about, you know, how challenging and intimidating that can be for many, you know, with how many lawyers are practicing, how competitive it is, how the, you know, the internet has changed the industry. So is there anything that, you know, looking back on it, that was really helpful for you to make that transition in such a short period of time from graduating law school? Obviously, the clerking being really helpful for you to get some experience about the procedures of the court and so forth. And so maybe that was, you know, one of the major components. But in addition to that, or maybe you could expand on that, you know, what really helped you make that transition to, you know, starting your own practice pretty much almost straight out of law school?
Sure. So, you know, as far as like courtroom and all that kind of stuff, you just kind of figure it out on your own as I went. You know, that wasn't too difficult. You can read the local rules. You know, I had a couple friends' parents who were prosecutors in the county, so I talked to them a lot. You know, just kind of made myself available and did the whole networking thing, went out to a lot of lunches, that kind of thing. But when it comes down to starting your practice on your own, the biggest thing is finding clients, and that is the toughest thing to do. You know, it's, you don't just open up an office and hope the phone rings, because it's not going to unless you do something more than that. So that was the biggest struggle starting out, is getting clients. And what really kicked off the practice was Unbundled. As soon as Graham called and gave his sales pitch over the course of a few phone calls, you know, that's really what did it. I didn't have like a stream of clients and by any means, really, until I started with Unbundled.
So maybe walk us through the timeline. So when did you graduate law school, and when did you start your practice, and then when did we come in the fray to help with solving that lack of clients challenge that any new solo is going to have when they first get their practice going?
Sure. So you know, you graduate in May, you take the bar in July, and then get the results in October, sworn in November. I clerked for a while, and then ended up just deciding to go on my own. And I did that maybe for 3 months or so before I started with Unbundled. So it has not been a long time at all by any means, but it has really just jumped off immediately. You know, just having the stream of clients makes all the difference in the world. So really the actual legal work is the easiest part about, you know, doing your own practice. You know, you have the expertise. You know, if you don't know the answer, you know how to figure it out. That's kind of what law school teaches you. They don't really teach you anything about practicing law. They teach you how to, you know, problem solve and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, the law part's easy. The getting the clients was the difficult part, and, you know, Unbundled really solved that starting out. So that's kind of like the timeline of how it went. It was very quick.
So basically, November 2015 was basically when you got sworn in and, you know, officially became a practicing attorney, and then you started on your own. Sounds like around June of 2016, earlier this year, about 6 months ago. And then we started working together, I think, beginning of September, right?
Yeah. So it would have been like end of May, would have been like the yeah. So that sounds about right. Yeah. So it's been very quick. And like I said, it couldn't have gone much better. I mean, once the leads start coming in, you know, the sales pitch is pretty easy. And so Graham, you know, walks you through that, you know, gives you kind of the example and you kind of role play a little bit and go from there. So we've all been through that with the unbundled, you know, kind of process. But, you know, these people, the clients are coming to you because they have some sort of problem in their life that they don't really know how to fix. And that's what they need help with. So it's not that hard to actually sell them on hiring you. A lot of it is educating the client on actually what they need done and, you know, pretty much educating them how they can afford to reach their goal of solving whatever problem it is that they have. And then I guess I should say that the area of law is that I'm mainly practicing in is family law. That's pretty much the unbundled leads that I get, and I also do criminal law as well.
Okay, awesome. So maybe let's give a quick snapshot of, you know, what those first 3 months or 3 or 4 months, May through September, look like for you as far as, how that went with some of the challenges you're facing, and then, you know, the beginning of September and how the last maybe 3 months have gone. Maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the transformation that's happened, or at least, you know, how many clients you brought on and so forth. Set some context on what you've been able to accomplish in these last 3 months, and then we can start to dive into, you know, how it is that you've been able to do so with the clients that we've been sending you and the types of options you've been offering and all that kind of stuff as well.
Sure. So, you know, starting off, like I said, the biggest issue is finding clients. So when I first started, it's like an embarrassingly low number of clients that you would have a month, a couple, a few, like it's just difficult to find. So in terms of like revenue, it's like very minimal from the start until I started with Unbundled. So I started with Unbundled September 1st. That's like the first day of leads that I got, right? And I think I got like something like 5 that day. and which is like blew my mind, you know, because, you know, these people are out there that need help. You just have no idea how to get in contact with them. They don't know how to contact you. So, so this is like the link between. So I think I got 5 that day and signed all 5. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, this is totally going to pay off. I can't even believe that I was, because I was a little skeptical about it. You know, Graham calls, and you get so many sales calls when you open your own practice. Like, it's just unbelievable. The phone rings and you're like, oh, great, a client. Nope, another, you know, sales pitch of someone wanting to sell you advertisement or something like that. Right. So my first phone call with Graham, I was like, oh, you know, this has got to be just another one of those things. And I thought about it and thought about it and talked to Graham more and gave it a shot. And I mean, from day one, it was just, you know, just paid off like immediately, which was really awesome. So,
by the way, it makes me curious, you know, when you're getting so many calls and so forth, what was it about the conversation with Graham or, you know, what you had heard about us? I don't know if you listened to maybe a couple of podcast episodes, but what was it for you that set it apart or at least made it something that was like, hey, you know, maybe there's something here that could be a fit for what I do or, you know, how I want to work?
Sure. I think one of the main things that set it apart or tipped me off that it wasn't like the typical sales pitch from an advertiser is just that there was no like obligation for any sort of length of time, no like subscription fees, nothing like that. And that's like the hallmark of all these, you know, marketing companies for law firms. They, you know, oh, we have a spot available on this website for you to advertise. You just need to pay us for 6 months up front, you know, something like that. And it's, you know, that's not at all what this was. And then the other thing that I did is my specific area that I have. You know, Graham was explaining to me like how the area came to be available, and he had mentioned the guy that had done it before. So I called that guy because he had moved on for whatever reason. And I thought, well, you know, if he's not doing it anymore, I want to know why. You know, just made sense. So I called him, and he had nothing but great things to say. And he moved on for, you know, family reasons or something. I'm not really sure why. He gave it up because I don't know that I would ever give it up now that I've been doing it. But so it was kind of that, you know, there's Graham explained it pretty well. I talked to the guy who was doing it before and then thought I'd give it a shot. And I'm really glad that I did.
Yeah, you know, and there's a few lessons on that. Certainly when you're looking at the calls, it's, you know, do companies require a long-term commitment, a contract? To me, to us, it seems like the only reason you would require some kind of contract or commitment is because you aren't 100% confident in the fact that you can deliver for the person that you're going to be working with, for the attorney. And so,
right.
You know, it seems like, you know, any kind of relationship, especially when it comes to marketing, needs to be a win-win-win relationship. You know, and we add the third win because we're also really committed to the success of the clients, you know, the people that we're sending to you. And that's, sure. You know, as much of our commitment as it is to your success as an attorney, because when we align our perspectives and our principles for the same purpose, which is how do we help that client, you know, we all win. But ultimately, it's, you know, making sure that, you know, this is going to pencil out for you long term and be something that's going to be a great fit for the types of services you want to offer and your goals and so forth. So, you know, that's a real hallmark of, you know, companies that, you know, really do have their heart in the right space and a service that I think, you know, is something you can have confidence in, is whether they're willing to, you know, offer terms where you can be able to try it for as long as you need and pull the plug for whatever reason it doesn't work. You know, the last thing we would want is, you know, to try to force a lawyer to keep working with us if for whatever reason that's not working and just, you know, take their money. So that's not the kind of, you know, relationship you want to create. It's not a long-term strategy. So that's certainly something that attorneys want to look out for when they're, you know, considering, you know, utilizing advertising services or any service for that matter that, you know, is supposedly supposed to help them grow their practice.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yep, that's the biggest cue right off the bat that, you know, it was actually a valuable service, is they don't have, you know, if you require a commitment, there's a reason for that. And it's because your whatever service they're trying to sell you may not actually work. So you're absolutely right about that.
Yep. All right. So let's dive into it. So what have these last 3 months look like? You know, maybe flesh out whatever you can. Doesn't matter. You know how many clients you brought on and so forth. And then they'll get, you know, set some context, and then we can dive into, you know, what your processes look like. You know, signing the first 5 clients is awesome. So we certainly want to get into the meat of what it is that you do to help you with such a strong conversion rate.
Sure. So I think right now, as far as conversion rate for clients or everything, I've gotten every single lead that I've gotten on the phone, which has been big. And then, you know, I should say there's been like maybe one or two where the contact information wasn't good for whatever reason. They input their number wrong or something, but you know, that'll happen from time to time. But for the most part, 100% of the people that had the correct contact and everything, I've gotten on the phone and spoke to them briefly about whatever it is that their problem is that they needed help with. And of all of the leads, I've gotten in-person meetings at my office, with probably 6 to 7 out of 10. And every single person that has actually come into my office and I've met with, I've signed, to some sort of service. So that's kind of how it's broken down and ended up with the leads. So that's been fantastic.
Do you have a rough idea of how many clients have come on then, and how many in the last, you know, 3-4 months from, you know, from square one, like roughly?
Yeah. So from September, I think I've gotten somewhere around 90 total leads. So, I mean, it's got to be, I mean, it's getting up there probably close to 65 clients out of that. That have signed. So, can't get much better than that. I mean, it's been really great so far, because there's always going to be, you know, some of the clients, for whatever reason, they might not actually be at the stage where they're ready to commit to solving their problem. You know, as far as family law goes, which is where I practice, I've had a couple of the leads where, you know, the dad calls and he's worried about getting custody, but then you find out the child isn't born yet, or so, you know, stuff like that. So we just put everything on hold. Okay. You know, wait and see how this pans out. And after, you know, the time period, you know, once a kid's born, if you still have the same problem, then we'll go from there. So, you know, there's been several people where it's just kind of, a wait and see type deal. You know, they want to commit, but there's really nothing to commit to yet. There's others where, you know, it might just not have any money. Which I talked to Graham about this recently, and we've talked about strategies to, to kind of vet that claim out, because, you know, there's a lot of people who would say, oh, I don't really have any money, but it's never really true. They might not have a lot of money. You know, they might be on SSI or something like that. And we talked about the strategy that I'm going to start trying, to kind of help them save up for whatever the fee is for whatever service they need. So we talked about, you know, explaining to them how a trust account works and setting up kind of a payment plan, whatever they can afford, where I would put the, you know, put whatever money it is that they can afford into the trust account. And then once it gets to however much they need for the service, then we can go ahead and meet, go over everything and get it done for them. So, you know, that might take 6 months, you know, to save up, you know, depending on their financial situation, but it gives them that option, so that they can, you know, actually get the help that they need, instead of just leaving discouraged. So both parties win, they get their problem solved. You know, we were able to get another client.
Yeah, and I recognize that that's something you're still, you know, experimenting with, but we've had a number of attorneys that have offered that as an option. And it really has been helping a lot of clients that I think without that structure, without having a specific amount that they're setting aside and having that deposited into a, you know, into the attorney's trust account. And there's even ways to do that in an automated fashion using, like, you know, an automated processing system like LawPay, where it's a recurring billing or something like that, where that just, you know, right when they get paid, that money goes towards their trust account. Without that structure, you know, a lot of people might spend the money or they might, you know, lose track. And so by having taken the time to go, you know, really flesh out, okay, well, if it's going to take this much to get the papers drawn and get it filed, and you give them a target they can see, and then you set them a structure where they can start making payments towards that even before, you know, so because most attorneys would say, okay, well, once you have the 1500, give me a call and we'll get started, right? Or once you have the 1000. Right. And, you know, a lot of folks will then go and, you know, have trouble coming, bringing that together, and that person kind of falls by the wayside. But if you continue to maintain that relationship and build that structure for them so they can start making payments towards that balance, and you help them with that, they're so much more likely to not only, you know, stay in contact with you and keep working with you, but also it gives them the structure a lot of people need to put that money aside and get moving in the right direction and getting things done with their case. And, you know, from what we've heard, a lot of clients really actually appreciate, you know, attorneys that are willing, you know, when the attorneys offer that option to them so that they know that they're moving in the right direction, even if it's going to take some time to take that first step and actually file their case.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and that I think kind of the education and training on basically just how to save is beneficial to them, because it just might not be something that they've ever done. And that's why they, you know, show up with this problem and they don't have, you know, they think they don't have the money to do it. But just takes a little bit of structure and encouragement, and you can, you know, show them the path to get their problem solved, you know, via some sort of savings plan for them so they can get the, you know, get it paid for.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we can really dive into, you know, the kind of questions you ask and some of the plans that you've put together that have worked well for folks. But before we do that, I mean, we obviously 60, 65 clients in 3-4 months is just an awesome start. One of the things you mentioned is that you've been able to reach almost 100% of the clients on the phone. We've talked about that a lot on the podcast, but, you know, briefly, you know, can you touch on your process, how you've been receiving the lead? Have you been getting it via the text messages? And if so, you know, when the moment that lead comes in, what's been your process for the most part to get in touch with those clients right off the bat?
Sure. So I don't do the text messaging. It just comes to my email. My email comes to my phone. So it's, you know, it's pretty instantaneous anyway. So once a lead comes in, you know, a lot of times I'm in court or something else when it comes in. So I try to get in touch with that person within the hour whenever that lead comes in. And sometimes you can't, you know, if it's 9 o'clock at night, you know, I'm not going to try to get in touch with them until the next day. But for the most part, that's kind of the goal I have within the hour. Try to call them. You know, a lot of times people don't answer on the first call because they don't recognize the number for whatever reason, you know, and so if they don't answer right away, I just call right back immediately. And, a lot of times you'll get the person on the phone, that second phone call, cause you know, bill collector is not calling twice in a row to hassle you. So, you know, I think that's probably what the people think, that, oh, well, maybe this is actually somebody I need to talk to. So, you know, that's one of the ways. If they don't answer again, I'll leave them a message. And a lot of times people will call me back pretty quickly once they, you know, realize, connect that number to, you know, the attorney they just tried to contact.
So you'll find, just to touch on that real quick, because I think it's important. Yeah.
So when you call them and they don't answer, you don't leave a message right then. You just hang up and you call them again right then and there.
Yeah.
And you find that a lot of people will then answer that second time.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. You know, cause I don't do it now, but previously, like, there's not many people that would call me that I don't have their number saved in my phone. So before I started my own practice, if I get a call from an unknown number, I'm not very likely to answer it because I don't know who it is. And, you know, figure they can leave a message or whatever. And most of the time it's just some sort of spam, you know, and I think people think that way. So if you call back right away, you know, then you're like, huh, well, it can't be, you know, spam or whatever it is, because they're calling back. They'll answer just to figure out, you know, maybe this is actually important, you know, and so that has been very successful. And it's just a little tweak of a strategy that helps get people on the phone, you know, quicker, which really, I think, helps that conversion rate. You know, the biggest thing is, I think, talking to people in person, you know, over the phone, as quickly as you can. And I think that that really helps the success of conversions just overall.
Okay. So yeah, so you get a few more people that will actually answer on that second call. If they don't answer, you leave a voice message. Some people are going to call you back for sure. Do you also follow up with a text message and an email, or how does it go from there?
So I actually don't. I have not done the text message or the email follow-up because I really haven't needed to. You know, that, and that is something that they talk about as like an initial strategy when I came on with Unbundled, and you're going through kind of the process of how to talk to leads and all that. You know, that's something that's explained, and they give you an example and that kind of thing. And I think there's value in that, but I just really haven't needed to do it because I've been able to reach everybody. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's the main reason why. I try to stay away from texting as much as I can, because what I found happens is there's no boundaries of time for clients. Once I've started that, that precedent of texting, you know, then you get the text at 2 a.m, you know, and so I try to avoid that, for the most part. And I really haven't needed to do it anyway. So it's been fine.
Okay, great. Okay. So obviously, you know, that's been working well as far as getting a lot of folks on the phone. Then once you're chatting with them, you know, we've talked, you know, a couple times about how to figure out how to overcome that financial barrier. And, you know, and this is something that's come up a lot is, you know, attorneys will say, you know, the clients are looking for pro bono, or they don't have any money, or they'll say that they don't have any money. And then that to them normally means, oh, well, this is a dead lead. I'm going to get off the phone. Or maybe even in the lead, I don't know if you've had some of these before, where it says in the lead, it says, I don't have much money, or I don't have any money right now. And so some attorneys just won't even call the lead because they're going to prejudge that that person isn't going to be, you know, a qualified person they're going to be able to help. And so, you know, how do you, you know, how have you been able to, you know, how do you look at that? And obviously that you look at that very differently. And how have you been able to work with folks that, you know, initially that seems to be, it's going to be a you know, a deal breaker or a barrier, but then it turns out to be, you know, not necessarily the case. And how do you flesh that out?
Sure. So, you know, and there have been a couple leads like you described where they'll put in the description of whatever it is, whatever their problem is, that they don't have a lot of money, or they're looking for a pro bono attorney or something like that. So I just don't really take that to heart. You know, I don't factor that in whether I'm going to call somebody or not. Of course, I'm going to call them to find out, you know, exactly what their problem is and how I can help. And you find that, you know, most people who have some sort of financial constraint, you know, you can work on some sort of payment plan or some sort of give them some sort of option that they can actually afford that helps them move forward. So just to give an example, I had a specific client that called, and she had tried to do most of the work herself. So this is a custody case, and it had already been through the process, you know, the magistrate issued an order and it didn't go her way, and she wasn't represented. So she already thought she had no money, tried to do it herself, didn't work. And, you know, she made a lot of mistakes because she wasn't represented. And, you know, that was part of the problem. So I talked to her for a while and we came up with a plan that worked for her financially. And she's head over heels thankful that she was able to find the help. You know, she contacted a few other attorneys before she ended up finding my information through Unbundled. And they basically were not helpful at all. You know, as soon as she says she doesn't have much money, they pretty much dismiss her and that was it. So they quote her some outrageous price or, you know, just dismiss her off the bat because she said she had a financial constraint. So, you know, I think you need to look past that just initial thought and really dive down into, you know, what the actual issue is, how their finances work, and what you can do to accomplish, you know, their goal of solving their problem. So in this case, she was one of the clients that started off with just paying a flat fee for having some paperwork drafted. So she wanted to object to the magistrate's order. So I said, okay, you know, she had X number of dollars up front. I gave her a couple weeks to come up with the rest of the money, you know, drafted the document, went ahead and filed it. Once she came up with the rest of the money, and it wasn't a lot. And then, you know, from there, kind of the process is you have to get a transcript of the hearing. So that was another expense. And it also buys you some time. So I said, we'll do this first. Here's the plan of what you need to save in order to get this transcript. And here's how much work it's going to be for me once I get the transcript to review and can amend the objection. And then here's how much it's going to be once we have the hearing for that objection, you know, and it goes from there. So started off with an unbundled service and it's kind of transitioning to more traditional representation, but just on a kind of a pay-as-you-go payment plan for the estimated amount of work. So it really helped her out, solved that problem. Instead of saying, hey, I need $3,000 up front for all these things that we're going to have to do, like most attorneys would do, you know, you break it down into manageable pieces so that someone who thinks they don't have enough money for representation, you know, actually can get the help they need.
Yeah, you know, and I really want to get into the economics of this because this is really what it comes down to is, you know, these other attorneys that they talk to, that this person talked to, obviously had the thought in their mind, oh, I can't make much money on this person or I can't make any money on this person. So I'm not, I'm just going to dismiss them. Which is what's happening all the time. You know, I'm sure you're talking to clients all the time that says, you know, I talked to this attorney, he says it'd be $5,000. I talked to this, it's going to be $3,000. They need it all up front, and you know, I couldn't afford that, so they just dismiss me because the thought in that attorney's mind is, oh, I can't make money on this person, right? Which, you know, what we found, you know, over the years of doing this and working with hundreds of attorneys across the United States, is that this isn't true. You know, is that you can absolutely, you just have to be creative about the way in which you structure moving one step at a time. You offering these unbundled options and doing these payment plans so that the person can afford it. And then also that at the same time, you're able to still make your hourly rate or get the flat rates at an effective hourly rate that makes sense. So can you talk about, you know, how you have been able to make money with like you, maybe you can use that example, that client as example, you know, so what were you charging for the flat rate for the document services?
Sure.
How much time did that take you? So we can kind of flesh out, well, what's the effective hourly rate of that? And then when you look at, you know, how it's progressing forward as a full representation, she's doing a payment plan. Are you putting in more hours than she's paying? Are you getting in a position where you're getting behind? Or is she keeping it up? Like, how do we look at this, you know, from a standpoint of, you know, are you actually, you know, what are the economics here of helping someone that, you know, many other attorneys would just turn away?
Sure. So, you know, to start, let's just think of the traditional, like, retainer, the way, you know, attorneys work. If someone comes up and says, okay, I need $5,000 up front to do this work and fix this problem, you know, the only reason that it's done that way is to try to ensure that you get paid. You're not doing all that work up front. It's going to take many months for you to bill against that retainer for the most part. So if you charge them $5,000 up front, you're not even earning that money, you know, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months down the road when you've billed all the hours against that retainer. So I just think of it, you know, kind of the opposite way. You know, come up with a figure that I need to get started on whatever it is their issue is. So in this case, I think I charge her $500 to draft and file the complaint or the objection to the magistrate's order. And then discussed, okay, if you want me to go from here, here is the hourly rate that it's going to be. And we talked about just the very next step in the process. Here's about how much time this is going to take for me to do this. So you have whatever it was, I think it was like 3 weeks. Let's see. I think it actually ended up being about a month. So to get the initial money, she got 2 weeks to do that, just the timing of when you need to object and everything.
To come up with the 500?
Yes. Okay. So she came up and she said, I think she had like 300 initially. So I was like, fine. So we did our first meeting, gave me $300. 2 weeks later, gave me another 200. You know, the objection was filed, and then...
Okay, so and was that 500, did that cover that? It recovered that objection, right?
Oh, easily, yeah.
Easily, okay. I mean, so how long did it take you to do that task, and what did you get paid for? So you got paid 500 for that, and then was there something else that was included, or was that just for that one task there?
So that was just for that one task, because she wasn't sure if she was going to actually, you know, retain me for the rest of it. So it was kind of one of those things. Okay, you know, I'll go ahead and draft this because she doesn't know how. I can file it for you, and then you know, she wanted to see if she could take it from there. After discussions with her, you know, we talked more, and she realized that this really isn't, the courtroom is not something that she can do. And that's, you'll find that with almost, I mean, every client. They're not attorneys, so you know, the courtroom is scary, and they don't really know what to do. So yeah, more than covered it. I mean, to actually draft and file the objection did not take very much time at all, if an hour. So
your effective hourly rate on that task was maybe, with including talking to the client, you know, for, you know, to explain it to her, maybe hour and a half total for the drafting and the conversations and so forth.
Yeah, that's probably pretty close to what it was. Yeah,
because most attorneys might go, oh, $500, that's not much. I'm used to getting $5,000, but you know, $500 for an hour and a half's worth of discussion and work, which is going to involve, is, you know, something like $375, you know, an hour or something like that. I'm not, my math isn't good, but that, right? So that's a pretty good rate.
But you're exactly right. And it goes to kind of the traditional backwards thinking. You know, they wouldn't even consider that. And that's why they're missing out. But the other aspect to this too, is I thought, okay, you know, after she came up with this money and we filed this, you know, there's a cost to getting the transcript of the hearing. So she had to come up with that cost, and that's set by the court. So that's probably specific to each county or area, whatever the cost is. So I thought this could go two ways. She could either not be able to come up with the money and, you know, miss out on getting that transcript within the time frame required by the court rules, and then this is over with. Or if she does, it tells me that she's committed and is able to save money to be able to afford the next step. And so she was. So she got the transcript of the court hearing at whatever cost that was. And then from there, we have 2 weeks to amend the objection based on the specifics of the transcript, based on whatever the magistrate's findings were.
Well, let's shine on that real quick, because, so, you know, given that the transcript was going to be an important aspect of her, you know, proceeding in this case, before you filed it and she paid the $500, I'm assuming you guys talked about that transcript cost coming and the time frame she had to do that, and making sure that she knew she could, you know, she could be able to afford that. Otherwise, it's almost worth, you almost have to kind of wait or not doing it at all if you can't, you know, see that whole piece right there to fruition, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. So we talked about that right up front. We got out the calendar and I showed her the specific days for when everything is due, when she has to have it, you know, in by, requested by, paid for, all this kind of stuff within the specific court rules. So So yeah, we talked about that right up front. So she knew from the initial meeting, you know, when she signed with me as a client, the time frame and the amount of money that she was going to be required to come up with to get this transcript. So, but again, my thought is, you know, it'll tell me if she is going to be a good client or not, if she's able to meet that deadline, because now she's had two financial obligation deadlines to meet, and she's two for two. So, you know, it just sets me at ease as far as like a risk of not getting paid. And
for going forward and continuing to work with her beyond that point. Right.
Yes. Correct. So then it comes down to, she gets the transcript, and the next step is, you know, reviewing that and amending the objection based on that. So we talked about how much time that was going to take, and then ultimately how much money that was going to cost. So she had 2 weeks to come up with the next payment. And so that only took a couple hours, you know, read through that, amended it, and then filed. And then I just told her, you know, by the date of the filing, I'll file it on the last day possible. That's when I'll need, you know, the next payment, right? Mm-hmm. And then from there, you know, the court schedules the actual hearing for the objection. So that's a couple weeks out. And so that's when she'll need the next payment for the time that it's going to take for the actual in-court hearing.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's amazing just going, breaking down the practice of law and just everything that needs to be done in a case to its individual component parts and dealing mm-hmm. with them one at a time. This is, you know, this is what's commonly referred to as pay as you go, but you know, this is a really, you know, we're really getting into the detailed description of what does pay as you go mean. It means that, like you said, you're not paying 4 months in advance, $5,000. You're paying 1 week at a time, one week after another, as the client can afford it, one step at a time. You know, and you know, that requires, you know, what I'm hearing is a real clear communication, like, let's look at the calendar. Here's what needs to be done legally. Here's where we need to be at financially by these dates, and making sure that everyone's on the same page and that these things are going to be feasible at the beginning. And then as you go along step by step, continuing to have that conversation around, okay, when's the next payment? When's the next payment? So you're working within people's budget, but also communicating what those deadlines are. And, you know, that's a constant aspect of working with folks in these bases is, you know, making sure that you're meeting each of these bounds, each of these deadlines as you go along.
Yeah. And as far as like from the lawyer's perspective, there's really no difference, you know, between this and the retainer as far as our pay goes, because, you know, the retainer goes in trust account, you bill against it as you actually do the work. So, so I'm not getting paid on any different timeline than a traditional retainer would be. It's just the client pays on additional, on a different timeline. And so
I almost want to ask you to like repeat that and yell it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Cause you know, you're putting a constraint on the client that is, you know, inhibiting your success and their goal of solving their problem by forcing this retainer, which the only thing the retainer gets you is security and peace of mind that you're going to get paid. But, you know, you can do it the way I did it with this client, and I'm not doing any work in advance. So it's not like I'm out any kind of work if she doesn't come up with the money, because I'm not doing it until I get paid for that segment. So it's really no different. You know, you can't bill against the retainer until you actually complete the work. And in this case, I didn't actually do any work until I got paid. So it works out the same from my perspective, and it helps out the client from their perspective. So it, you know, it helped this person get the help that they need where otherwise they wouldn't have been able to do it.
Well, yeah. And furthermore, when you start to break up each phase of the case into tasks, then it also gives you the ability to bring in the effect of having an effective hourly rate for a flat rate task, right? You know, if you're going to take a billable hourly rate of 5,000 and it's 20 hours at 250 an hour, regardless of all the tasks that are in there, you're just going to be billing at 250 an hour. Whereas if you're doing documents and getting that delivered to the client and you work out a flat rate for each of these tasks, now all of a sudden you can start to leverage. And right now, you know, I think you're still working as a solo practitioner, but down the road, what a lot of attorneys have done is they hire a paralegal, they get some document automation software, and they'll still quote the 500. But the question then becomes, you know, is it going to take me 2 hours to do that at 250 an hour, or could I do it in an hour and a half, or maybe even an hour, because I have a paralegal that's going to draft up those documents and or automate some of the doc preparation with technology. And so now you can actually increase the amount you would earn, you know, from all the phases of a case by getting creative and offering flat rates for each solution, because obviously you're delivering added value to the client by offering options in which they can pay as they go, you know, that other attorneys wouldn't even touch their case for them. So that's a huge relief. Like you said, she's just, you know, over the moon happy because she's able to work with you on a basis that she can afford. So she's really happy. So you're bringing that value to the client. And so at the same time, you can extract additional value by offering flat rates and being efficient with your time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think that's, you know, where a lot of attorneys don't factor that in is getting creative with offering these options and starting to become more efficient so that they can see an even higher effective hourly rate than if they'd got all the money up front and just billed everything at one hourly rate. Okay, so and then from there, so you've had some of the clients, maybe you can talk about the different options you've offered. So we've given kind of one hypothetical example where you started at, you know, a flat rate task and then you're doing one step at a time. So maybe that's one approach. Have there been some other options, or maybe you can do a more of an overview of the different kinds of options that you've been putting together? Some people paying, you know, a bigger retainer up front, others doing just unbundled and going, you know, and then being done and just proceeding themselves from there. I mean, maybe you can start to give an overview of some other options that you found you've been offering as well besides that.
Sure. It's really come down to, I mean, you could call it three options, but it's really just two. So when I meet with the clients, I literally have three different, you know, client engagement letters drawn up, you know, based on what we had talked about. So they have an option to choose from, like quite literally in front of them. And so the cheapest one obviously is the unbundled service. So a lot of times it's just, you know, drafting and filing whatever documents that they need done. Right. So that's pretty easy. And then, you know, the middle option would be something similar to that. Here's what it'll be to draft the documents, and then here's kind of an hourly rate going from there. And if you just want me at this, you know, specific hearing or whatever it is, here's how much it's going to be. So, you know, kind of a hybrid, and then, you know, the traditional option of here's the retainer and hourly rate and everything. And again, try to keep, you know, the retainers low compared to other, you know, attorneys and firms, and really just depending on the client's needs and the complexity of the case and that kind of thing. Because we can always transition to a situation where it's more of a pay-as-you-go once that runs out. You know, and so pretty much the by far the majority of the clients end up choosing the traditional representation. The biggest, you know, the biggest factor in their decision-making is going to be financial. You know, they've a lot of them have already talked to other lawyers, other firms, they've been quoted this big retainer and they just don't think they can afford traditional representation and all this kind of stuff. So, so it's really just kind of educating them on how they can afford the service that they need and what specifically the service that they need is. You know, they'll initially want to gravitate towards the unbundled, you know, just, document, production and filing and that kind of thing. But that's really not what they need. They need actual representation. The courtroom is unfamiliar to everybody. That's what people are uneasy about. That's where the questions come in that they don't know the answers to. You know, the courtroom's a scary place if you don't know what to expect and you have nobody to ask while you're there. So that's really why they need representation. So we just work out a way to educate them on how they can afford that. And so the option is always going to be, okay, you can do this unbundled option and I will draft the necessary documents and get those filed and get the case started or whatever it may be. And then later, once it comes time to go to court, you know, if you are not comfortable going by yourself and want me to represent you, call me and I'll be there. And here's, you know, how that will work going forward. And I've had a handful of clients where that has been exactly how it's gone. You know, they wanted to do just the cheaper option. And then they ended up, you know, realizing that they wanted somebody there with them in court to represent them in a more traditional sense. And they've called back and hired me on that basis. So that's happened a few times. But for the most part, during that meeting, that conversation steers them to the traditional representation service. And it's just a matter of coming up with terms that they can meet and they're comfortable with financially, so that they can be successful in whatever plan we set for them as far as payments go, and they can get, you know, their problem solved.
Right, exactly. And maybe what we could do is, you know, flesh out, we've talked about, you know, having them get started with the unbundled option where you've got the draft documents drafted, you're usually offering the fixed flat rate, like the $500 rate we talked about, and then, you know, going one phase at a time from there. Maybe you could talk a little bit further about how that limited appearance works, and, you know, at least in your local jurisdiction, because what's interesting is every state is different about how they deal with a limited appearance, or, you know, how you're representing someone for just one hearing. How does Cincinnati, the local courts, work around you as far as offer being able to offer one appearance? Is there some kind of form you file or way you notify the court that you're going to be doing that? And if so, you know, have you had any challenge with, you know, getting off the record, you know, once you've done an appearance for a client in your local court?
Well, so in every case, I haven't actually needed to do that, because what happens is, you know, even if they decide that they want a limited appearance, they switch. So it ends up not being just a limited appearance, because they realize once, you know, the day before court or even the day of court, you know, they realize that they cannot do this on their own. And they need you there the whole time. So the closest thing that I've had to a limited appearance was a client who already filed. This was like a motion of contempt for a divorce decree. You know, the specific person had a debt that was supposed to be paid by the other party. It wasn't. You know, she had everything filed, had all of the documentation, everything there. She's just like, hey, I don't really know what's going to happen in court. You know, and I just feel like I need somebody there. Can you look over this and, you know, represent me? Sure. And, you know, I'm not even sure that would really be like a limited basis, because it's just, you know, one contempt hearing and that was it. So it ends up being that people, you know, nobody wants just a limited attorney, a limited basis representation. Everybody wants a full service representation. The only problem and the only reason they consider any other option is financial. So you just have to work with them and educate them on how they can actually afford to get the representation that they want, which is full rep.
Right.
So that's been the process. That's been the whole idea of steering them into some sort of situation where we can all get what we need. I can get paid what I need to work for them or work with them. And they can afford to have the representation that they need and deserve.
Yeah. And so maybe let's take a closer look at that as far as how you've been able to work with clients on offering a, you know, full representation under a basis they can afford. Because, you know, I would assume most attorneys that don't offer that option, it's because they're afraid they're not going to get paid, that they're going to get stuck representing someone, you know, being on the record. I'm sure that happens to, you know, to every attorney, even, you know, eventually happen, you know, to you, you know, in certain cases as well. But, you know, how have you been able to, I don't want to say prevent that, but how do you work around that fear? How do you address that concern that you're going to put together a, you know, a lower retainer and then, you know, make sure that, and how do you ensure that it's a plan that is going to work, and also you're not going to get in a position where you're providing a ton of services and getting way ahead of what they've paid you?
Sure. So a lot of that, you know, that starts in the initial conversation with the client, and once you are kind of vetting the complexity and merits of the case, you can kind of determine, you know, in the ballpark of how much time this is actually going to take you. So once you determine that, then you can kind of figure out, okay, you know, what are the financial constraints of this client? How much can they afford initially as far as a retainer goes? You know, from my impressions and talking with these people, do I think that they're going to follow through? Do they have, you know, a stable enough income to where I'm comfortable, you know, with them saying I can make this payment and them actually being able to follow through. So that all comes into play when determining kind of the initial retainer, but I try to keep it as low as I can, because I understand, you know, they have a problem that they need solved and they don't know how to do that. And it can be a scary place, especially when it's, you know, something like your children being taken away from you or something like that. You know, you don't have many options. You don't know where to turn. You know, if you did, you would do it yourself, but you just can't. So I try to work with them the best I can, because you got to empathize with their position too. And so it comes down to, I've had a couple, you know, a lot of the clients where it's just, we talk about where they work, how much they get paid, specifically when they get paid. That's very important. And then talk about the time constraints of the case. So a lot of times there just aren't any, especially if it's, you know, somebody wanting visitation or to file for, you know, custody or joint custody. They might not have any sort of specific time constraint where they have to file, you know, the initial complaint in. So we'll come up with a number of whatever that retainer is. So say it's $1,500 and they only have $800, you know, today. Okay, fine. So, you know, let's go ahead and meet. You know, a lot of times what I'll do is ask them when they get paid next and then ask if we can meet on that day. So if they get paid every 2 weeks, they get paid on a Friday or whatever it is, we'll meet on Friday, their next payday. And then they can, you know, make the first payment. Okay, I'm going to, you know, we'll hold this. And then 2 weeks from now, when you get paid again, we'll need the rest of the initial retainer. And that then I will file the paperwork and get started. And then we can go from there. And we'll have a discussion up front saying, okay, the retainer covers X number of hours. I think the total case is going to be, you know, this many hours, which a lot of times will be right around that ballpark. So, you know, we'll say, when I file this, this is kind of the timeline of how this case is going to play out. From the initial filing to the conclusion could be X number of months. So once we get that first retainer, I think it might be, you know, 5 more additional hours of work more than this retainer. So by the end of this case, we're going to need to get X number of more dollars. So we'll set up some sort of payment plan to go, you know, forward to figure out that cost. So, you know, it's different with each client in each case. There's so many variables to it, but, you know, it just comes down to working out a plan that will work for the client and work for you, and, you know, making sure that it's reasonable that they can stick to it. You know, if you try to set up a payment plan and, you know, the person can't meet that obligation, you know, it's really not their fault. It's, you got to figure out a plan that works for them, that they can stick to. If you make the payments too high and they can't meet them, they're not going to, you know, it's, you know, they want to get the problem solved. I don't think anybody is out there to try to stiff you on purpose. You know, you just have to come up with some sort of plan that actually works for everybody so that you can get it done.
And have you got any experience so far of, you know, what plans have worked well, what plans haven't worked well? I mean, it seems like the main consideration is the time factor of the court and and the rate at which you have to get the work done by is the main, you know, is the main limiting factor, I would say, of, you know, how you can put that plan together. But do you have any feedback on what's worked well, what hasn't worked well, and how to work around those time factors?
Well, you know, if there are some pretty big time constraints, it's going to have to be, you know, a higher retainer up front. But it just depends on how many hours of work that are needed and that kind of thing. So I had another client that, you know, we talked about just the financial constraints, and he wanted to make sure that any task that he could get done, he would do, so that, you know, it kept the cost down. So the best thing that you can do in all these situations is make sure that you have a really good line of communication, which can sound, you know, it can cause an issue, because of course you want to bill your time when you're on the phone with your clients or whatever, solving their problem. But I mean, you just need to be able to communicate precisely what needs to get done and when, so that everybody's on the same page as far as schedule and timing and everything like that. So especially when there's time constraints, like there can be oftentimes.
Is there a way where you are able to have like something you give to the client where they have a clear schedule, or do you put it in their calendar, or is there a way when you communicate that they know, you know, I don't know, just to keep them organized? Is there some things you've developed to make sure that that happens?
Well, a lot, you know, yeah, I'll put together like a payment schedule if it's something like that. So, you know, it's pretty much corresponds with however they get paid. If it's weekly or biweekly, you know, I'll send an email, you know, actually write up a letter. You know, we sign during the meeting when we come up with a plan. So the plan is written down. Here are the dates of the payments that need to be made. Here's the amount. You know, and all that kind of stuff. They sign it and then, you know, I scan it and email it over to them or whatever. So they have it. And we, you know, we stick to it. So you have that tool. And then if it comes to, you know, Friday payday and, you know, the payment isn't there or whatever, you know, and call them up and, you know, everybody hates chasing the clients for money, but, you know, at some point, you know, you're going to have to do that. But when you have it this structured, it really helps everybody to stay on the same page. They have a goal that they can see visually, that they know what they have to do to accomplish in order to get the help that they need. So that's worked pretty well for me. And, you know, at the end of the day, they need to have their problem solved. That is their goal. You know, they came for help and that's what they need. So they're going to try to do everything that they can to get that problem solved. And this is just part of it. So, yeah, you know, writing down that structure has been pretty helpful. I haven't, Graham and I talked about this. I really haven't taken too many credit card payments. For whatever reason, for the most part, people, you know, have cash or, you know, a certified check or something of that sort. So I know, you know, we had talked about how you can automate payments and things like that. But it really hasn't come down to that for the most part, for me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there is a way when you start to get, you know, higher volume of clients where you can put that together into a software and just have it process automatically, which is in some cases can take off some administrative burden, and also can make it easier for the client too, because they just know that the payment is going to go out automatically, and only in the event that the software, you know, ends up, you know, that payment not processing successfully, do you have to have that conversation, as opposed to having a conversation each time you need to make a payment.
All right. Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing, you know, the results you guys have had and the solutions the strategies you developed to do that. There really is, like you said, there's plenty here, folks. It's just a matter of restructuring the way you think about how to work with those clients. So I thank you for being so transparent about the way that you've been able to do that. And we're really excited about our future relationship and continuing to send you as many clients as we can that are in need of services in the Cincinnati area. So thanks again for taking the time today to jump on the call.
Thank you.
All right. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. For everyone else that's been listening, we certainly appreciate your participation and jumping in on these podcasts every single week. If you're enjoying the podcast, feel free to share it with anyone else you might benefit that maybe has been charging these full representation standards up front, and give them an opportunity to start reconsidering offering these options and really start to look at the economics of helping more folks. And certainly if you're enjoying the podcast, go on iTunes and leave us a review or rating, because we certainly appreciate and read every one of those reviews, and certainly helps promote the show so other lawyers can hear about it and learn more about these options. So we appreciate that support as well. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you all on the next episode.
For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.